Good afternoon and welcome to The LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. It is September 8th, 2007, and I want to begin by wishing Lyndon LaRouche a happy birthday. He is 85 years old today and more than ever is at the center of the global battle to pull humanity back from a plunge into a prolonged new dark age. His most recent paper, which is titled Music and Statecraft, How Space is Organized, is a truly magnificent piece, and it continues a kind of a series he's been writing in recent weeks, which is written in part to provide a new generation of leaders with the ideas and insights into the quality of thinking which is needed to pull or to deal with the deadly crisis we're currently facing. And you can find this new paper on the LaRouchePack.com website, and I would encourage people to go pick that up and read it as soon as we're done with the program today. Now, I will be speaking with some of those up-and-coming leaders today on the program. We will be discussing the organizing drive to get the 110th Congress to pass LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act of 2007. In a communique this morning, Mr. LaRouche said there are only two options for dealing with the ongoing disintegration of the world financial system. Either you act to save the hedge funds, in which you bail out the institutions which are responsible for this escalating crisis, or you act for the nation state and the people and the banking institutions which serve the people through investing in communities and industry and education and so on. In other words, we're facing an all-out battle between the forces of a new global Anglo-Dutch financial oligarchy and the forces of the American system, with national constitutional remedies for this kind of crisis. Now, there may be some of you who are still living in delusion and fantasy and agree with Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, who said last week that the credit crunch and the resulting chaos is just an episode, and it's now under control. If so, you should think again, or maybe for the first time. Let me give you a different metaphor that was used. The CEO of Barclays Bank, which has been bailed out on several occasions recently by the Bank of England, he said the world financial system had a heart attack in August, and we will see in the next 4 to 6 weeks if it can survive. Now, that's more in line with what Mr. LaRouche has been saying. Let me just give you a couple of quick headlines to make the point that this is not going away before we get to our panel. First, yesterday, Countrywide Financial announced 12,000 layoffs. As its stock continues to plunge, it was revealed that Bank of America, which bought a $2 billion piece of Countrywide, which is really a thinly disguised bailout, that on that $2 billion investment, the Bank of America has already lost $700 million, and there's no way to go for Countrywide but down. Secondly, a report issued by various agencies which track housing showed that one out of seven homes purchased with subprime mortgages is already delinquent and heading toward default. And third, as the interbank rate continues to go up, which is the interest rate that banks charge each other in short-term loans, the credit crunch is continuing because of the high rates, and it's forcing central banks to pump billions of dollars a day into the financial system to keep the meltdown from occurring. So, as Lyndon LaRouche said, there is a way to reverse this collapse, and that is his legislation, which would put a moratorium on home foreclosures and then a firewall around the banks so that banks would remain standing to service the real economy, while the funny money in the outstanding commercial speculative paper is allowed to evaporate. So let me begin the panel discussion by bringing in Ligaia Rabolos from the National Center. We will be hearing from LaRouche Youth Movement members from every region in the country on their organizing efforts to break the Congress out from under the control of the hedge funds and also break them free of their own fears of stepping out of the rules of the game. So we start with Ligaia in the National Center, who will give us an overview of what we're seeing every day in the organizing process. Ligaia, how are you?
Good, Harley. Thank you. Well, I just wanted to start with what Lynn had said yesterday. from our discussion when he said that it's the state legislators and the people around them are the ones who will actually kick the Congress in the rear end and in the head if necessary to get the national legislation passed, this HBPA, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. And we really have been on the offensive in the state legislators as well as the city councils to mobilize and organize the lower levels of the institution. And so we've actually been very successful at that. They're really saying that, okay, well, now that we have this meeting, that we would call them, we say, look, we have the solutions to the mortgage crisis. And they're just very open to it. They're like, okay, when do you want to meet? And so with that, we had 14, with calls made like that in the Midwest, we actually had 14 meetings set up for next week with Ohio legislators as well as Michigan legislators. And so it's something that the population is very aware of. And it's not something that they're in denial about. They may know about it, even though they may not get the depths of it, but they're very open to the solutions coming from it. And if we keep in mind that this legislation is the first legislation coming from a series of Lynn's step-by-step method to save the physical economy and dump the financial system, then that will actually give the organizers on the ground a sense of, okay, this is what we have to pass first. And then after this, we can take it further to something else to which LaRouche can actually give us another policy to put in place. And so, and with another example also coming from the Midwest, where a speaker of the state house we met with, and he said that he's not only going to go to his own congressman, but he's going to go to 10 congressmen and actually speak to them about this legislation, LaRouche's legislation. And that's what we're really trying to create on the ground, is we have to get the legislators, the state legislators and city councilmen, to organize each other, to organize themselves, to then go to the congressperson and create the kind of pressure to the congressman.
So Lagaya, I presume in the center there you will be getting reports coming in from the regions, and then you'll be coordinating that with the forces on the ground we have in Washington, D.C.
Right. Because LaRouche usually lays out a concept, and it's really our job to figure out how we can make that concept due to strategy and different methods of organizing to bring that conception about.
One of the reasons that Lyndon LaRouche is emphasizing the local situations is that once a congressman is in D.C., they have constituent services and they hear from various people, but actually they don't live among the people. They're not really on the scene the way city councilmen, county commissioners, and even state legislators are. So what we should be looking at is an all-out offensive. And let's begin with the Northeast, New England, where we have Megan Beetz with us from Boston. Megan, why don't you give us a report on what we're doing in the Boston area?
Okay. Well, I'll start with something that actually happened a few months back. We, up here in New England, we had a Massachusetts State Democratic Convention in May. And there are three resolutions passed on the floor of the convention. Two of them were introduced by us. And significantly, we introduced a resolution exactly identifying the threat of this housing crisis, identifying that millions of people are standing to lose their homes, that it was a threat to the entire banking system, and that what was necessary was an FDR-style reorganization of the banks. And it was interesting because the only fighting point and only point of debate on this entire resolution before it passed was exactly on the question of whether or not a banking reorganization was necessary. But the resolution passed by a two-thirds majority of the 2,000 delegates. So that was put on the record. We warned these guys, and we immediately got the resolution into the State House the week after the convention. Now, since then, we've been proven right. And our region actually is coming out of a pretty intensive week of music work with our singing teacher, Maestro Briano. So the mobilization this week was really just the tip of the iceberg. but I can say just a couple things. One, we mobilized to saturate the entire state house with literature, which is just up the street from our office. We also did a sweep of calls into the state house and didn't manage to set up any meetings yet, but sent a team in there, which had a few impromptu discussions. We also began calls to the Boston City Council, and we managed to set up a meeting for next week with the city councilman. We also just saturated the campuses up here with literature, which are a huge part of the institution of Boston. More what I'd actually like to focus on is our perspective for kicking into high gear for next week. We have a couple things planned. One of them is that the New England area is historically a very intensive manufacturing area. The downtown city of Boston, not so much. That's where you get State Street and, you know, different hedge fund central. But the outlying areas, Lowell, Massachusetts, Lynn, Massachusetts, Brockton, these are the areas that are being hit by the housing crisis. And these are the areas where you have people who understand the necessity of FDR's policies. So we're planning a mobilization to contact the city councils of all of these outlying areas and mobilize there. We also have some labor contacts. We have a plan to invade the state house with teams of people. And we also have a plan to branch out into the states in New England, like New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Maine, and see what we can stir up there.
Well, one of the ironies is that, of course, Massachusetts is a traditionally Democratic center, and you have a Democrat named Barney Frank, who's a congressman who's on the Banking and Finance Committee. And from the reports we got from the committee, he indicated, despite the fact that it's clear he knows the problem, that he's one of those at present lining up in defense of the hedge funds. So are you going to be doing anything special to bring him around to reality?
We're going to organize like hell in his district. Yeah, we have to hold his feet to the fire because he's been warned about this. He got a copy of the resolution. We're speaking to all the political layers in Massachusetts, so we're gonna make his constituents hold his feet to the fire and make sure that he knows that he's acting against the Democratic Party of Massachusetts if he doesn't support this resolution.
Okay, well that looks like a good plan, Megan. We'll get back to you in a little bit later in the program. Let me go to the Midwest right now. LaGaya mentioned some of what we're doing in the Midwest. We have Shauna Rodarte with us from, I believe, Detroit, although she may be somewhere in Ohio. Shauna, how are you doing?
Hello.
You there?
Yeah. Well, yes,
okay.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Sure. Why don't you give us a report?
Right. Well, one thing is we do have a number of meetings set up in Michigan this coming week, about 5 meetings, and then in Ohio the following week, about 9 meetings set up. And so far we've only had several meetings this past week. So that's to come. But one thing that's been effective is instead of going through a secretary to set up a meeting and then meeting with an aide, we'll go to events that we wouldn't normally go to, maybe like ribbon cutting events or maybe a meeting on health care, and meet with these reps face-to-face and different political officials, including congressmen. Just follow them where they are, because the situation, the mobilization that we're in, makes these events a little bit different. Even if it's just a ribbon-cutting event, you'll still have a reaction from the population that they want to talk about the economy. So that's been fun, because you kind of like get to skip to the chase with the state rep or senator or congressman and get their reaction right then and there.
Now, Shauna, with the economic problems in Michigan, the shutdown of the auto industry, also in Ohio, there already has been a significant increase in the foreclosures, people losing their homes. So do you find that the local officials are still in denial, or are they clear that there's a problem?
They're clear. And they're clear that it's systemic. It's not a local problem. It's not a state budgetary problem. They're clear that there needs to be federal intervention, but they're pessimistic. They say, well, yeah, I know it needs to get done, but they're not going to do it. So you just tell them, like, because you know better than most people, and I tell them I myself know better than most people that these guys aren't going to move, because I meet with them and I know their character. but because you know it has to get done, that shows you what you need to do.
Now,
do
you think that this problem, I mean, I've heard it said that there's a higher degree of pessimism because of the accelerated rate of breakdown, but at the same time, in Detroit and the near vicinity, that should heighten the sense of necessity to act, shouldn't it?
Yeah, and that's what they realize when you bring it up. If we weren't here as a youth movement, they would definitely stay pessimistic, but because they're so close to reality. But when you say, yeah, because you see how bad it is, you should know better than anybody what needs to get done and how hard you have to fight to do it, they get inspired very easily to want to fight with you. What do you want me to do? How do I sign up? How can I contribute? This is the population and the elected officials.
All right, and Shauna, we'll come back to you in a couple of minutes. I want to go now to Houston, Kalina Hemphill. Kalina, there was a major effort this week to reach legislative offices in Austin, Texas. There's a plan for a trip up there. Now, of course, the Texas legislature meets for about 5 days every other year, and they do a couple of stupid things and then go home. But what are you finding with the offices that you're calling?
Well, yeah, just like you said, everything in Texas is big, including their vacations. We did call into the state legislature, and through just a concentrated block of calls for maybe 2-3 hours this week, we lined up anywhere from 25 to 30 meetings. People are definitely ready to meet with us on the issue. The depth of their understanding may not be that great, but there is a large number of offices that are receiving calls from constituents specifically on this crisis. So it was very easy to mobilize around some type of a solution, and that's what Lynn's presenting.
Now, you said that they told you that they are starting to get calls from constituents?
Yeah, there were a couple of offices that said, we have gotten a few calls. We don't really believe it's a huge problem, perhaps because of the housing boom in the 80s here in Texas, which you might want to go into a little bit, but there definitely is a recognition of a problem in the housing sector. There might not be the depth of understanding that it's systemic and can lead to a crisis in the banking areas or the economy as a whole.
Well, the other thing that's big in Texas is self-delusion. And there's an immense capacity, bigger than 10-gallon hats, for self-delusion. And so the line in Texas is that, well, we're counter-cyclical here. The rest of the country is suffering because of high oil prices, but that's good for Texas. The fact is that that's just a sign of the delusional nature. What happened in the 1980s in Texas was because of the deregulation that was done against the savings and loans and that destroyed the savings and loans, which actually is the precondition for the crisis we have today with mortgage-backed securities and so on. What was done in the late 80s is that there were 40 to 60,000 foreclosures a year through the mid-80s, with I think in 1986 there were 44,000 foreclosures in Houston alone. And so anyone in Texas, I mean, some of the people you're talking to may be too young to remember this, but that was a huge crisis. Texas only began to recover from that in the late 1990s, and now they're kind of smug. They think, well, we're sitting in hog heaven. We're okay. But I think that that's where we have to go after the delusion in Texas.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, they do believe that they've learned something from the problem in the 80s and the early 90s. Therefore, they didn't buy subprime mortgages or adjustable rate mortgages. They believe that that makes them safe, in a sense. When I just happened to meet somebody on the street the other day who is banking with Bank of America and was completely unaware of the crisis that they're in. You mentioned earlier that they've already lost $700 million due to a bad deal with Countrywide. So people are definitely starting to understand through our organizing how this will affect them in every other area of the economy that they don't consider.
Well, you know, in the early 1980s, during the following the 1978 price hike in oil, when Texas was making money and the rest of the country was complaining, there was a bumper sticker which appeared in Texas, which said, "Drive 90, freeze a Yankee," and this was sort of the smug Texan prior to the blowout when the oil prices fell in 82, 83 to $10 a barrel, and the Texans started losing their homes. So you've just got to keep ridiculing this idea that Texas is its own country. Now, another place where people think they're their own country is California. At least the governor of California thinks he's the emperor of a state. But we found some very significant reaction there because of the crisis in California is immense. So let me start with Summer Shields from Oakland. We were in Sacramento last week. Summer, what was the climate there?
Well, there was a we went there a week and a half ago, and that was when we first initiated the housing mobilization. And we got a whopping 18 meetings and several callbacks with offices that wanted to engage in meetings with us. And we found in every office we went to that foreclosure was the topic of discussion on the Capitol. And so it just happened that reality and us coincided with their recognition of reality, and we both wanted to discuss the housing foreclosure and what to do about it. And there were several offices that were already in motion on wanting to do something that wouldn't work. And so we got in the we were able to engage in some good in-depth discussions with people and bring out the realities of the banking crisis as opposed to just a foreclosure crisis fairly easily. And there are only a few offices that opposed it, but then in a series of Socratic debates, they were forced to have to recognize that this was bigger than just a foreclosure crisis. And, of course, the largest responses came from places like Riverside, where Countrywide is in Riverside, and places like Stockton, which is the fastest rate of foreclosure in the country. And these were people who were ready to listen. We brought the old EIR we had on us about the housing bubble collapse from 2006. And we told them that we had been putting out stuff on the housing bubble since way longer and long before that. And the response was considerable. People were forced to reflect on the fact that, yeah, it's true, that is what you guys were talking about on a number of occasions. And we went back there again this last Tuesday, and we got less meetings, but at least a considerable move in a direction towards partnership with city level people. We met with an advocacy group, a housing advocacy group that Ian had set up, and the discussion went well, and they are going to try and get us to speak before their executive board meeting sometime this coming week. And just to put the emphasis on it, we did go up there. We went up there with the Boston resolution that you guys had, Megan, and that you had passed at the convention. And people were like, okay, well, you guys got this passed. Well, that gives us some hope. And so it was very good. A lot of people had been changed by the nature of this thing.
Now, Summer, let me just take it a step further then in terms of the California situation, where it is fairly advanced. I spoke to an official yesterday who's involved in the housing agency in the state level. And on the record, he was telling me, oh, we're doing this, we're doing that, we have town meetings, we're doing this, and we're looking at predatory lenders, and we're looking at more transparency. And I said, look, what you're talking about is closing the barn door after the horse has been turned to glue. This is a little late, isn't it? And he said, can I go off the record? And I said, sure. And he said, I'm really frightened. This is a much bigger problem than people know, and we can't address it in the state. We have no money. And he said almost every single bill that's been introduced is either of the sort that's talking about punishing predatory lenders, most of whom are going to be out of business by that time, or to come up with a little bit of money to help people either stay in houses or expand shelters. So on the state level, there's very little they can do. Are we effectively orienting, and this is for Summer and everyone else, do you think we're effectively orienting people around this idea of kicking the Congress to move the Congress? What do you think, Summer?
Well, as it stands, we're going to be going back up to Sacramento to do some more orienting for these guys. A big problem is that a lot of people are either in just total awe that we got a few officers that showed a similar sentiment where they said that they don't know where they're going to get the money from. They tried to say, well, didn't they take the loan out themselves? Isn't it their fault? I don't think they really believe that as much as they are just kind of overwhelmed by the situation. But we got at least a couple of officers that recognize that, yeah, maybe we'll have to extend the session past September 14th, where the state legislature is supposed to be leaving. And at least a few people who said, okay, this is a federal fight, we agree. And the housing advocacy group said that. We talked to an aide who told to one office who told us to talk to her husband, who's a city councilman in the Sacramento area. And so it's going to take more kicking, but it can work.
All right, well, let me bring in Ian in just a second. I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is The LaRouche Show for September 8th, 2007. And we're live every Saturday from 3 to 4 Eastern Time. If you don't catch us live, or if you're catching us live but you want your friends, if you're sitting there saying, darn, my friends should hear this, my contractor, my banker should be listening to this show, well, you can get them to pick it up on the archives at LaRouchePub.com. I also want to encourage people who are listening to go to the LaRouche PAC website, where we have a copy of the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act of 2007, so you can download it. You can produce as many copies as you need. You can go to your city council. You can go to your county commission. You can go to your realtor unemployment seminar, because a lot of realtors are losing their jobs. You can take this out and mobilize support for it. So that's available on the LaRouchePAC.com website. And if you want further literature, hard copy of the EIR or other literature, particularly the webcasts, the most recent webcast where Lyndon LaRouche discussed this, you can call us at 800-929-7566. Now, we just heard from Summer Shields, who's with a team in Sacramento. A member of that team is Ian Overton, who is now in Washington, D.C. And Ian, you were able to use your experience in Sacramento to start mobilizing in Washington. Why don't you give us a report on what you've been doing?
Sure thing. Glad to be here, Harley. I'll tell you that not much would be happening here in D.C. if it wasn't for the offices that are organizing like crazy across the entire country. By teaching the citizens and the elected officials there some of the past 3,000 years of history and the American system of Alexander Hamilton, that's the groundswell that actually allows us to do things effectively here in D.C. And actually, as a result of the Sacramento mobilization, we were able to set up meetings with some very prominent Democrats here in the Capitol, because the people who saw what was going on there were making calls and briefing them on it. So we did get a meeting with a California senator, and the sorts of questions that they had were they. One of the first things they wanted to know is, well, what sort of support exists? So I was able to describe exactly how we were organizing in Sacramento, and the effect that this has, and that the legislature there is somewhat frustrated. Because while they know they have to do something, they don't know what to do, and they're thinking that there's not going to be a lot of support or leadership coming from the national level. So we made it clear that the states are really looking to the federal government to take some leadership on this. So they asked us some questions. They wanted to know, well, what sort of support is there, and they also wanted to know what should we be doing in terms of a proposal. Most people were putting out the line that, well, what about this Dodd-Hagel bill? We think it should be called the Roatan bill, the Felix Roatan bill, but they were asking, well, can't we just have renegotiations between lenders, and can't we just use a public-private partnership to do this? And well, we had to let them know that that's just not possible, because all the PPPs went bankrupt when the entire subprime mortgage bubble blew out and the entire banking system went bankrupt last month.
Now, Ian, just so people know this, I know some of the all of the members of our youth panel know this, but some of the listeners may not. Felix Rowetton is squatting on top of the Democratic Party. He's a Wall Street banker. He's a longtime partner of Republican George Shultz. The two of them collaborated to impose the fascist Pinochet regime in Chile in 1973. Rowetton is nominally a Democrat, but he's actually a fascist from Wall Street. And one of the things that Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized is that a problem inside the Congress is the extent to which you have a lobbying force that's directed by Rowetton and Shultz, with hedge fund operators and others with a lot of money, who are basically buying up congressmen. Now, Ian, you were on the scene this week when you had a chance to see some of this happen. How bad is this?
Well, it's like LaRouche recently said, that there really is one group which supports what we're pushing in terms of a Franklin Roosevelt solution to this bankruptcy. And there's another group which wants to sacrifice the banks and the housing to save these hedge funds. And so it really is a knockdown, drag-out fight. And you have Democrats who are disagreeing with other Democrats. You have Republicans who are disagreeing with the status quo.
So you're seeing some bipartisanship then, people in the Republican Party as well who are reacting against this collapse.
Yes, absolutely. This came out at a recent hearing, several recent hearings in the House Financial Services Committee's different subcommittees, and also the full committee, where the chair of the entire House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, he was kind of putting out the line of the hedge funds, and he was saying, well, he's so surprised this happens, and it doesn't seem to me that any of us charged with responsibility for knowing what was going on anticipated this. But, I mean, despite the fact that's not true, we've organized all over, especially his constituents in his offices. But what the people were doing is other people were disagreeing. Ken Jorski, who chairs the subcommittee, he said it's simply ridiculous to try to put more of this debt on to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and some of these housing institutions. And also at this same hearing, Congressman Baker, from a Republican, was articulating some of the things that were needed in order to deal with the savings and loan crisis, such as creating the Resolution Trust Corporation. So they do know what to do in a basic sense, and they're also somewhat aware that what's going on is totally not working, and they know that their districts are getting hit really hard. Also at this hearing, you had Congressman Baca, who was testifying, and he was speaking on the. And he was saying that, you know, his district ranks fourth among foreclosures in the nation. So one out of every 33 families in his district is getting hit with a foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So they know that the situation is bad, that it's bigger than any one of their own states. And they also know a little bit of some of the history of things that were done to deal with this crisis before. The problem is that they don't understand what Hamilton did when he created a national bank. They don't understand how the American Revolution was actually a fight against imperial trade and the oligarchy and the British Empire, the East India Company. So they don't have this sense of history, and so that's how sometimes they're taken in by the lure of the Shultz and Roach and types and those who are advocating the hedge funds.
Well, let me come back to this point, because I think this is an important point. I want to open it up to members of the panel who might have something to say on this. We're hearing a lot of these people, including Barney Frank, say, well, we didn't see it coming. It was unpredictable. No one could have seen it coming. Well, in fact, if you were reading EIR, if you were listening to Lyndon LaRouche, if you were hearing anything said by the LaRouche Youth Movement in the last 7 years, or actually listening to Lyndon LaRouche since the mid-1960s, you knew this was coming. Now, I'd like to throw it open to the panel from different people. Maybe we can start with Megan. How do you communicate this idea that, in fact, it is predictable and there is a method by which you can know truth? Because this is what Lyndon LaRouche has been writing about in a whole series of these recent papers. Megan or anyone else, you want to jump in here and talk about how you organize people and recruit people to understand these principles?
Yeah, well, I can say one thing. And all this, I just want to add to some of the discussion here. Massachusetts actually did pass a bill, which was a completely impotent bill back in August, just bailing out the lending companies and offering financial counseling to poor, naive borrowers. So you have a delusion in people's minds, and that's the problem that we're running into in terms of the state house and some other political layers. So, I mean, one thing that I know you have to do is you have to get people to see what a delusion they've been in. And we've been having fun this past week organizing, experimenting with how to get people to laugh at the past 30 years and the fact that the past 30 years' policies have been absolutely insane. And tonight we're having a class by Paul Krangold on why humor is necessary to get out of a dark age. So I'm sure we'll have some more ideas after that.
Ah, so you'll have the Yiddish Renaissance presented in its most lasting and powerful way, the discussion of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Shauna, we actually did tell people in the auto industry, including the auto workers and the unions, 2 years ago, that they were headed for dismantling at the hands of the hedge funds. Is this part of the reason some people are pessimistic, that they heard that it was going to happen and nothing happened, or is there a way to get these guys to laugh at themselves and get moving?
You see it on the campuses when you're trying to describe the way you would solve this crisis. You show that it has to be something that's outside the system. You're going to have to be a little bit creative to figure out how to create a new system that won't collapse in the same way. When you're able to describe that process of creativity of how to solve a problem, it also shows how you can forecast a problem when you're determining what is guiding the process as a whole. And the young people are loving it. They love the idea that there's something you can do about it. It's not just the way it is. So yeah, I don't think that's why they're pessimistic. The only reason why anyone's still pessimistic is because they haven't listened to LaRouche and don't think that there's anything we can do about it.
So you're taking people through the Kepler's development of the orbits of the solar system to get them to understand the basis of forecasting?
Maybe not right there in the field, but yeah, our contacts over a period of time, yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, also, anyone else from Kalina or Summer or Ian, how are you getting across this idea that we're seeing the end of the system? I mean, one of the things that I discussed with the LIM, both on the West Coast and in Houston the last couple of days, is that if you look at American history, there have been a series of periods of growth and expansion and potential with the American system policies of Hamilton, starting with under Hamilton and Washington. It was revived to some extent toward the end of Monroe's administration and then under John Quincy Adams. It was ended by Andy Jackson, and we had 30 years of depression and drive towards civil war until Lincoln came in. Again, with the assassination of McKinley, we went into a period of free trade, British imperial policies until FDR. And now again, we're seeing something which is the end of an era. We're actually at the point where an era from the mid-1960s to the present can no longer continue. And I'm just curious if people on this call have developed ways of communicating this to young people who, of course, their whole experience has been within this system, which is now disintegrating. Kalina or Ian or Summer, you want to say something on that?
Yeah, I can say something from Houston. Young people, like you said, have been indoctrinated into this system since they were born. What you notice with the older generation, specifically because of the history that Texas and Houston have around science and technology, they actually had a bastion of creative potential powers with NASA, with a huge medical field, with an agro-industrial area, you can actually situate the crisis that we're in now with the collapsing infrastructure for the younger generation to see. They've known the United States to be supposedly a superpower, and when you confront them with the paradox that you have people dying by driving over a bridge on their way home during rush hour.
Yeah, some superpower.
It really poses that question. What does your country, how does your country actually take care of the general welfare of the nation? And that's really posing, I think, the correct paradox to people of what is necessary to create a physical economy. And the second question that comes out of that in terms of this crisis is, what is leadership? And if you take a cue from Lynn, leadership is not purely the courage to act. We've seen that leaders like Bush and Cheney we've seen what they can do with the power that they're given. Leadership also has to be a collaboration with the knowledge of truth, which you mentioned our rigorous scientific work. So if you can actually situate that for people in the context of your organizing, I think it really opens up the potential.
And Summer, I assume that you're finding something similar in California, where the people there sometimes brag that if California were its own country, it would be the seventh or eighth largest economy in the world, and yet they can't come up with a budget, they can't keep their hospitals open, they can't fix their roads. Is it starting to get through those laid-back Californians that they're in trouble?
Well, we told an aide that if you would be the seventh largest country in the world, you guys are acting like Rhode Island. You guys, that's not a good thing. And, she didn't like that very much, but she had to smile. She got the point. And up in Sacramento, it's kind of a weird thing because you get on the campuses. We went to San Jose State University, and the response on the campus, no one denied that there was something very bad going on. And we got a number of high-level student contacts and the student government who were interested in what we were saying. So that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Ian, are these paradoxes, I mean, clearly you have people who are talking about AmeriCorps, they're talking about infrastructure. I mean, it's an interesting problem where the administration keeps talking about how this is a strong economy. The Treasury Secretary Paulson said it's the strongest global economy he's ever seen, and yet bridges are collapsing, people are losing their homes, we don't have medical capabilities to take care of people, there are 50 million people without insurance. Surely this sinks in with the Congress.
Well, yeah, I mean, you kind of be surprised sometimes what sinks in and what doesn't. But, you know, this really makes the point that LaRouche emphasizes consistently, which is that really in order to communicate principles that are of a universal nature, that which are true throughout time and history and also anywhere you go in the universe, that irony and metaphor are absolutely crucial tools. Because oftentimes the Congress and the situation that's in the halls as you're walking around and going through these offices is one where people are either even more laid back than California, or they're just way, way too serious. And so both of these problems lend to a kind of an academic view of what's going on and some of the historical precedents. And so what we've been doing is we've been developing our organizing around communicating these sorts of conceptions using irony, using metaphors, to actually draw upon those aspects of our culture that people know but may not be thinking about. And I'll give you just two examples of that real briefly. Well, for one example is that you have a Hurricane Katrina storming through the banking system. And so we need to erect levies in the sense of LaRouche's firewall legislation, because people are just going to get swept out to sea if we don't take these sorts of precautions. And this people respond very well because they all know that it's an open wound on the nation. So when you can draw something like this out for them and show them the similarities, that's a very powerful organizing tool. And with offices where we've actually gotten responses that are very much like, yes, you know, you're right, this is very true. This is a systemic banking crisis. It's often fun to point out things such as how Dante Alighieri put the usurers in some of the deeper levels of the inferno, and that there's a reason why he did that. And so people, because most people have read The Divine Comedy, or at least the first book of it, but they don't necessarily think of today as having any relevance to those stories.
Well, very few of them, Ian, ever get out of purgatory or hell when they read it, so that's part of the problem.
Yeah, right. But when we can draw these sorts of things out, we can begin to, you know, sprinkle real humanist culture back into their minds, and they begin to actually think about these things and the relevance of stories that are several hundred years old.
Ian, let me quickly ask you one other question, then I want to get back to LaGaia on the coordination of this mobilization. But you are from Alaska. I know you were quite enthusiastic about LaRouche's proposal for a Bering Strait tunnel and this kind of organizing perspective. Then there was this conference last spring in Russia where it was put on the table of a tunnel connecting Siberia and Alaska and coming with rail lines sweeping through the western states of the United States into Central and South America. And there's also a significant groundswell of support for this in Alaska. Does this ring a bell in Washington, D.C. when you talk about infrastructure? Are people excited about this idea?
Well, they don't understand the implications of it in terms of a policy for war avoidance, a policy for providing jobs. In the last 2 weeks, we've been emphasizing this Homeowners and Bank Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with the upcoming conference in Frankfurt, Germany, that'll probably shift some things. People, they get excited about trains, but they don't necessarily get excited about a full-on infrastructure development program to create new resources, because they're still thinking in terms of a fiscal budget, not a capital budget. So they do need to start thinking in terms of the coming two generations, and, you know, Hamilton's a great place to start for that. I mean, read his report on the constitutionality of public credit and, you know, why manufacturers are necessary. And, you know, that'll begin to actually make the Bering Strait Tunnel and those sorts of connections much more, not just like a great idea or something that sounds nice, but actually something that's crucial for the survival of the United States.
Okay. You're listening to a panel discussion of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement on the LaRouche Show today. We are taking this discussion up now because, as Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized, the next 3 to 5 weeks we'll probably see a series of further ratchets and possibly a vaporization of the financial system. And he drafted a proposal, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act of 2007, which is the emergency first step to protect the United States by putting a moratorium on foreclosures to literally prevent the homelessness of between 5 and 10 million Americans. And then secondly, as part of it, to create a firewall around the banks, modeled on what Franklin Roosevelt did when he first came in as president in the winter of 1933 to protect the banking system while weeding out the bad speculative paper. So those are the two steps that would be taken by this act. As I said earlier, you can get the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act on the LaRouche PAC website, and I would encourage everyone to participate in this mobilization. Now, LaGaia Rebolos is in the center. She's in what we call the war room, and in a sense, that's because we have to organize this as though we're fighting a war, because we are. LaGaia, how are you going to be able to centralize the, what are you going to be doing to make sure that we maximize the effect of this organizing?
Well, we have to organize our fellow organizers and to actually keep, well, if you think about it from the standpoint of holding a flank, right, and actually having, holding a line in just any battlefield, you have a unit that moves together, right? And so what we're actually doing in the war room is making sure that we don't break the line. Because how the line works in any battlefield is that you actually plug any kind of breakage. If there's one person or two people that break the line, you have to constantly plug it back in or your enemy can just invade and take your flank. And so one of the war room's function, other than just briefing the locals and briefing Lin to actually keep his eyes and ears on the ground, is that we have to ensure that the line won't break. And so we have to have constant dialogue within the locals in the region and say, okay, how are you maintaining and escalating the kind of organizing that's necessary in the state and city council, state legislators and city councils, so that we can actually have the momentum in D.C. that they can organize around that.
And Lin keeps saying, stick to this as an issue.
Right. And so that's what we're trying to have. That's our stronghold, is this flank. And we have to, the war room's duty and function is to maintain that line, is to not break the line and to ensure that, look, this is only one of the series of battlefields that we're engaging in.
Now, we have a couple of questions that have just come in from emails. We have two from Robert Hill from Arroyo Grande, California. And this is for anyone on the panel. He wants to know, can you mobilize the student populations for action? Are college students or youth aware at all of this crisis? So I throw that open to anyone on the panel.
Oh, definitely. I would have to say we actually had a discussion once in the war with the war room and with Lin about this idea of searching for people among the ranks of the population and actually develop them. And you can actually use them as an example that they're coming out of a backward culture or a backward, you know, just being raised within the CCF culture. And that's what the youth movement represents, is that we're actually a grouping of students, or used to be students, that came out of the kind of culture that we were immersed in, that's basically set up for to fail.
Yeah, I would add also that it's only by mobilizing the student body population, the 18 to 30, 35 age group, that we're actually going to make this sort of breakthrough happen. Because these are the people who are going to have to live with the decisions that are made now for the next 50 or 60 years of their life. So that's, you know, we have to start there.
And Shauna, you were saying that you were getting pretty good reactions on campuses also.
Oh, yeah. For one thing, it's fall, and so freshmen are coming in right when the whole financial system's blowing out. So it's very easy to stop people, even though they're not finance majors or know what a hedge fund is per se. There's just a changed environment that they're coming into as adults, coming into adulthood in a very charged environment economically. So it's very easy to find the innate leaders on the campuses and then give them direction and nurture them.
So is it a general consensus of all of you that this should be a period of recruitment, major recruitment for the LaRouche youth movement?
Yep.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I think it'd be a lawful response to what's going on in the world.
Absolutely.
All right. So I think that is a consensus. Now, there's a question here on an email which I wanted to answer, but for some reason it popped off my screen. So, George, if you can get it back up there some way. It's from Teresa in Spring, Texas, and while I don't have it in front of me right now, the essence of the question was, given the fact that there's so much private ownership of infrastructure, here it is. She quotes from the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, where it says, federal and state chartered banks shall be protected so they can resume the traditional functions serving local communities and facilitating credit for investment in productive industries, agriculture, and infrastructure. So she asks, if Congress implements this act, how can local governments address the infrastructure crisis when most of our public infrastructure are leased to private entities for many years? Now, her question is very important because that's precisely what Rowatan has done with this, and Schultz with this privatization policy, to try and transform everything into toll roads, toll bridges, sell off water systems, power systems, deregulation, and so on. Well, the obvious point is that once we get this Homeowners and Bank Protection Act in, we're going to have to go with a national infrastructure policy, which will not be private. It will be modeled on the FDR policies, the TVA, and so on, which means that there will be government financing, government credit, and the government will offer for contracts private companies the opportunity to participate, but they will not be owned by private entities. And it means that these areas that are these toll roads and others will be phased out of existence. We're going to, by reviving real economic development, most of this public-private infrastructure, which is really just a theft of public resources by private companies taking advantage of financial crisis, that's going to be reversed. And once we have the economy running, we'll have more than enough funds created, generated in real wealth to pay down the costs of the initial credit. So we're going to reverse it, but it has to be done from the federal level down to the local level rather than the local level up. So we have just about 3 minutes to go. Let me just go back to Ian. We have just a couple of minutes. What's up this week in the Congress? Are there a lot of events?
Well, we've had ability to just have a whole bunch of meetings as a result of some of these financial services hearings and House Ways and Means hearings. And so, I mean, for one thing, that's on the schedule. But they're going to continue to have discussions on things such as what's going on with the banking system, what's going on with the breakdown of our transportation networks. There's going to be hearings on the bridge collapse. So there's going to be a lot of things that I don't know if you're looking for something specific, but yeah, I mean, they're going to be talking more or less about how we need to fix things, and we're going to be intervening to make sure they go at it from the highest standpoint.
And I want to reiterate what Ian said earlier, which is, of course, what Lyndon LaRouche has been saying, hit them in the local areas, hit the local elected officials. And I'm certain from what I've heard so far today that all of you are planning on that. Megan, you have anything else to add?
Just that we're going to mobilize like hell. And one thing, Lynn, I want to stress is what Lynn stressed, that the way you get the population to move, which is how we're going to win, is to give them a sense of history. And to give them an identity that they're actually participating in a sweep of history that's going to impact the next centuries.
I think that's pretty good advice. How about anything more from Kalina?
Just to follow up with what Megan was saying, the way that we were organizing students was actually telling them that if they want a future for the next 30 years, they're going to have to be crucial in implementing that future. And that's really actually challenging these students to take a minute and say, yeah, I do want a future. What can I do?
Summer, Arnie Schwarzenegger, what are you going to do with him?
We'll let the devil sort them out.
Well, let's send them back to make Terminator 10 or something like that and have him terminate himself. All right, and let's see. Did I catch everyone? Shauna, anything for you in the last 20 seconds?
No.
Shauna thinks I always set her up. All right, well, this has been a very useful discussion. I hope you've been listening. Those of you on the computer, get your friends to listen to this show. This is the youth leadership of the future preparing to win this fight now, because the crunch is on us. Bernanke and others have no plan. The hedge funds want to save themselves and sink you, and you've got LaRouche and the LaRouche youth movement fighting for you. So this has been the LaRouche Show for Saturday, September 15th, 2007. Thank you for joining us, and join us again next week when we'll be live at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you.